have the same feelings everywhere you go. People have the same feelings everywhere you go. A laugh's a laugh and a tear's a tear. When one's afraid, it's the same old fear. And when joy fills the heart, it fills the heart. Ooh, yes, joy fills heart. And there is the same old yearnings everywhere you go. People have the same yearnings everywhere you go. A want is a want, and a need is a need. No matter where, they've got the same kind of greed. And when hate rules the heart, have mercy, it rules your heart. I don't believe in all the madness they're preaching. It's the same old thing to me.
That's the legendary jazz and blues singer Joe Williams with Same Old Song. It was one of his favorite songs to perform live. This one performed live at Vine Street. It's from his 1987 album titled Every Night, Live at Vine Street. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Free Your Mind Friday. You are in the driver's seat, taking the conversation where you want to go, but with your permission, we ask that we can have access to your mind. Can we hack your mind so we can find out what it is you're thinking that would help us understand the world that we live in a little bit better? 888-874-4888. Clearly, we see how things are developing. It's reached a point now almost of a war threat by President Barack Obama, saying that the United States will retaliate against Russia for its alleged interference in the presidential election. However, the stories that I've been reading, nobody is specific about whether there's evidence or evidence has been found specific to Russia and its alleged interference in the election. There's been nothing that I've seen, and I've been reading and reading to find out what the results have been. I'm so surprised that although there was a January 20th deadline, it seems as if a report is already available. And of course, it came to the predictable conclusion, but I was looking for the evidence and didn't see any mentioned, just unnamed sources saying that they believe strongly. Which is okay, that's good to believe strongly, but is it evidence? And we'll see how this is developing, and we will talk about that next week at some point, because what I want you to really focus in on is how this developed and was given so much speed to the point where it is now, and how it is being used and manipulated to get the American people on board with the idea that, yes, this is legitimate, yes, this is true, and it is about the Russians targeting Hillary Clinton and the government discovering it just in time so that it could affect the Electoral College vote. And so the possibility exists for an upset still. You know, it's how they play with our minds. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. This is your time. This is your forum. From Wisconsin, Habu, you're on the air.
Yes, warm greetings to you from a very cold, cold Wisconsin.
I know. You know, the first time I went to Wisconsin, I couldn't believe my eyes. In the midst of all that snow, there were people having picnics in the park.
Those must be cheeseheads.
It was bizarre. My sister lived in Manitowoc, and it was just weird to see that you have all these people out in the park, you know, grilling hot dogs and hamburgers and having a great time. To them, it wasn't cold at all. But what are you offering today?
You know, I missed this show on last Friday when you have an open forum like this. And I wanted to bring up, although it may be a week late, the whole matter of the, the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock and the resistance. And if I'll do it with your permission, of course.
Well, sure. Go right ahead. This is an open forum. You can discuss whatever you wish.
Yeah. And I want to just delve into that just a little bit more than I've heard on the mainstream media. You know, these people are not going and meaning the Dakota Sioux are not going out there, you know, inviting trouble or anything like this. It's because a pipeline with dirty oil was placed 1/2 mile upstream of their drinking water supply. And what they're doing is they're saying, we don't want it here. You reroute it downstream somewhere or elsewhere, but not up just upstream, immediately upstream of our water supply. But let me just list some incidents. And you know, it just shows the sadism that the police state of North Dakota, the governor, and that Morton County sheriff have displayed against these people who are largely peaceful. They're, you know, in out on the prairie, you don't have bricks and rocks and all to hurl at the police. One incident was how they just used brutal tactics, going and disrupting their camp, and then taking the people's IDs and wallets. And then these people were without them, and then just dumping them out somewhere in the middle. I mean, totally, this would not happen in other places of, dare I say, white America, you know. Another incident was where this Native American had a bullet hit her eye, and she was bloodied, and then the real irony was that she was taken about 40 miles away to Bismarck Mandan, where they have hospitals. And then when they discovered she didn't have her ID or her health insurance, they threw her out. And what happened was she likely is going to lose sight in that eye because that 72-hour window, there was no treatment given to her. Another thing is spring water in sub-freezing weather. This kind of goes back to Nazi-type tactics, you know. And then when you compare the way the government authorities dealt with Cliven Bundy in Nevada, that rancher who didn't want to pay his fair share, or the Malheur Center in Oregon where these people took over those federal buildings, it was a kind of a hands-off approach by the police authorities. And, you know, it then was finally negotiated. But here these people have immediately struck these people. And also one horse had to be put down in this protest in the Dakotas, and also dogs biting people who are not really, involved in violence. So this is very... this is a kind of an eye-opener for American people to see that there's this disparate types of treatment meted out to indigenous people.
Well, the sad thing is they have a long history of being treated this way. And for me, the central question here is a matter of sovereignty. It happens that the Sioux and about 100 other bands, as they're called, who were defending their land were doing so on the basis of their sovereignty as sovereign nations. This was not at all recognized in the whole struggle. The United States just refused to recognize that these were independent sovereign states by law, by treaty. And here we have a blatant example of the history of the abrogation of rights and the trampling of sovereign rights by the United States, where you have people who have a right to make certain decisions. It's their land by law, by treaty, by history. And none of that seemed to have been recognized by the U.S. government and by the corporation, the several corporations operating as one here, of the recognizing the sovereign rights of the people. And this is a very grave violation, I think, but it has been consistent over the last how many years now? Hundreds of years. At some point, the United States will have to account for that, and I think it's sooner better than later, because as we had a professor from Colorado, I can't recall his name right now, talking about the history of treaties and how the United States government systematically has just ignored its obligations under treaty law. So this, to me, was the most significant thing. A conflict such as this required nation-to-nation negotiations, it seemed to me. There was no evidence of that here, where you have an ambassador from the United States engaging with the diplomatic representatives of the nations and working it out in the same way that they would work out any other diplomatic issue. This is a continuing insult, and it ought to be corrected, especially, I think, when members of Congress should be stepping up to the plate here and reaffirming the rights of the First Nations people to the land and control of the land, which is what sovereignty is all about. In a sense, the pipeline becomes a kind of undergirding argument for it, but not the center of the argument for it. But the question, the larger question is, when will the United States honor treaties, and does it not recognize that it has an obligation here to observe the terms of treaties and the sovereignty of these First Nations? And this is a big issue, I think.
Indeed it is. And, you know, it's ironic because I'm never a great supporter of the military because I see it as the vanguard of the imperial reach. But decent American veterans returning looked at this and said, I went and fought abroad, and here they're treating my fellow Americans like this. And it was that influx of, mostly white veterans who went there and stood between the water protectors and the brutal police people, and that tipped the balance. And then finally, and shamefully, this president, blinked and had the Corps of Engineers issue a stay. But anyway, thank you very much. And if I do not talk to you anytime soon, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Thank you so much. Thank you. From Ithaca, Mike, you're on the air.
Hello, Therese.
Hello there. How are you?
Okay. I'm afraid I'm going to bring something up a little bit controversial, but I want to let you know before I bring it up, when I first heard your program and learned of your existence, I said, I love this person, as if she were my flesh and blood. But
thank you.
if I may disagree with you on something, I want to say one thing, but I need to preamble it with a little story, but a true story. There was a four-year-old girl who got a chance to walk with her father at Christmas time when he was off work. And when they saw a cross with the statue of Jesus on it, she said, "Who is that man?" And he said, "He was someone who came up with an idea that you should, that everyone should treat others the way they want to be treated themselves." And the little girl said, "Sounds like a good idea," but the father said a lot of people didn't like it, and they executed him. And then on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, the father was off work again, and they went into a restaurant, and someone had left a newspaper on the table opened, and there was a picture of Dr. King in the paper. And a little girl said, "Who's that?" And he said, "Well, he was a man who went around with a philosophy saying that the way we treat people should be the same, no matter what they look like." And she said, "It's a really good idea, but I bet you they killed him too." And that being said, there was a doctor on your program, and I'm sure as a doctor, he must have taken the Hippocratic Oath. And I was shocked that he was there for almost an hour talking, whether you like Hillary or you don't. He was, that's irrelevant. But he was talking about how Hillary wasn't fit to rule because of some abnormal condition she had with her eyes and focusing them both together on things.
You're talking about Dr. Ted Noel.
Now, I want to tell you, I've spent most of my life, hang on a second, my allergies are getting me. I'm sorry. That I have spent most of my life working very hard to become a scientist, to have a career as a scientist, but being discriminated against because of the way my I can't make eye contact. And I've been accused of thefts and lying, and people who were open-minded enough to hire me or impressed by my work, or women who were didn't worry about what I looked like and were willing to be my significant other, were harassed by lots of people who pressured them to discriminate against me. They had to let me go just to avoid all the harassment day long. At the University of Arizona, they had to hire a secretary full-time just to field all the phone calls of people complaining about things I allegedly done. Even when I was away from the campus for a year, the calls came in every day. And so I know what it's like to have one's life ruined by people judging my character by my appearance. There are even invasions of my offices
but
or apartments.
If I could interrupt, just a second, I want to get to the point
even police.
Where do you disagree with what Dr. Noel was saying?
Oh, that he shouldn't have tried to judge Hillary's character by any physical traits that she manifests, basically.
But he wasn't judging her character. What he was saying was that there were signals or signs that were quite apparent that she was and has been experiencing the effects of a disorder or a disease. And this is not known. And it became so blatantly clear on the occasion of the commemoration of the 9/11 bombings that she literally, I mean, it was undeniable then that she was dealing with something. In his view, she exhibited all of the signs and signals of Parkinson's disease. And
that should be no reason
apparently been dealing with these things for quite some time. The Clinton campaign and the Clinton, the whole entourage were in denial of this. Nobody's saying anything about it. And it's on the basis of that he was saying that somebody needed to come clear and come clean about whether, in fact, or just about what is this disorder that she clearly has, and it's apparently getting worse. So he was speaking from that point of view. I don't think he made a personal or character judgment about it. other than to say that it's time to get some honesty about this.
I agree. If she has it, she shouldn't cover it up. But on the other hand, that shouldn't be an excuse to deny her any job or any ambition.
Yes, but this is not any job, because one of the things, this was his argument, Parkinson's, I mean, if it were a matter of, let's say, a broken leg that doesn't affect your capacity to think or reason or doesn't have a disorienting effect, when you're dealing with this office of President of the United States, it is imperative that you can reasonably guarantee you have sound mind at all times. It
that's,
is
that's
not
assuming,
like...
That's assuming that this isn't just a stereotype. And if you listen to Gary Null, which I'm sure you must, he had a story just a few days ago about reversing Parkinsonism, even when it's severe, and people not only getting better, but... being better
I'm saying, okay, it's if there's a view that it is reversible, but the fact is, the bottom line is, it has not even been acknowledged that she has Parkinson's disease, and yes, there's every effort to cover up whatever it is that is going on with her health wise, and it seems to me it's like a pilot.
Well, FDR, I mean,
you would not hire a pilot knowing that the pilot is an alcoholic. Flying a plane and all these people are in it. So this is the point that Dr. Noel was making. If it is Parkinson's disease, and she's showing apparently many of the signs and symptoms, and she has been showing the signs and symptoms of it for several years now, it is a degenerative disease. And if it is not acknowledged, let alone dealt with, and a strong effort made to cover it up, then we have a right to know. The people have a right to know what is this disorder, because it has happened in public several times. She has experienced these disorienting symptoms many times in public. They've documented it. She's been required to have help to just get her up the stairs. She goes through certain, she has what I would call a slight immobilization. She just stands there, and nothing happens.
Hang on, Therese. What do you think of FDR covering up that he was in a wheelchair? Was he a bad person?
But the nation knew it. That's the whole point. The nation knew that he was. He had suffered from polio. He was stricken with polio. That had nothing to do with his mental acuity. It did not affect his mental capacity at all. So, and it was not hidden. I mean, you saw him in his wheelchair.
He covered it up for a long time. He covered it up for a long time.
Well, he covered it up for some time. You can't hide polio. You just can't hide the effects, the damaging effects of polio. It was inevitable that it would be discovered. And at the time, people had some strange ideas about polio. And it was felt that, people would not pay attention to the gifts that he had because he had polio. And they didn't want a president who was in a chair and all this other kind of stuff. But those days are gone. And in any event, he proved to be quite competent, even if people disagree. But he proved quite competent mentally to do the job and did it pretty well.
Well, what people should look at, they should look at what Hillary's record is for what she's done and not her physical condition.
No, you don't want to suggest that at all. Her record is abysmal. Her record is horrible.
Yeah, well, if it is, then you don't vote for her, of course, but that should be your reason. No, it's just fact.
It is just fact. When somebody can have a laugh at, an assassination that she planned, in Libya,
she's done some god-awful things.
Out of control. This is a reason to worry. about the character of a person like that and what such a person is likely to do in the capacity of leadership of a country.
I agree with you there wholeheartedly that her behavior record is abysmal in many ways. But one shouldn't be bringing up her physical traits. This is all I'm saying.
But it's not physical. This is the point that Dr. Noel is making. This is a neurological disorder. Parkinson's is not so much a physical problem. It's a neurological problem.
Mental diagnoses are a form of...
And it's degenerative. So it will inevitably get worse. This is the point.
There was no
reason to hide it. There still is no reason to hide it.
And you're right, it shouldn't be hidden, seeking
the highest office of the country with a strong likelihood of success, knowing that she has a disease that is neurological in order, that would affect her thinking, would affect other things too, like her ability to walk and so forth, but mostly the ability and capacity to think. This is a very dangerous thing, considering that person in that position has the power and authority to push that red button. So he was bringing this to light in order to stave off the inevitability of the election of someone whose health status is very much in question. That's all. It made no additional judgments about anything, except that the evidence suggests that A, she has Parkinson's, and B, it's getting worse. Thanks so much for calling and contributing today. New Hampshire, Nelia, you're on the air.
Thank you for your deep thinking, Nutrice. Consistently deep thinking.
Thank you.
I call just back and struggling with bronchitis. I was out at Standing Rock in the Ocheti Sequin camp. www.ochetisequincamp.org is where the Peace Pagoda monks guided me with my race class Mayflower baggage. I was able to leave some of that behind traveling with an Afro-American brother. We were able to bring 238 straw bale from Massachusetts, a huge carbon footprint, but the North and South Dakota supplies have dried up, partly because of the drought, partly because of politics. Their highest priority for winterization. Profound, humbling, deeply inspiring. I arrived December 2nd, midday Friday, before the Sunday-Monday deadline to clear the site. I came with the intent of offering my white privileged body as a human shield, as did many, many vets. The Veterans for Peace were there in strong numbers. Wesley Clark brought a group. There was a third group of vets, all offering their bodies as shields. This is not what the Native leadership desired at this time. And so we were able to be of service in the camp. I have never, ever witnessed the profound level of wisdom, leadership, orientation, training. I'm a third-generation pacifist. I've worked my entire life in nonviolent social change. I do feel I've been preparing my entire life for this action. Seabrook was a burial mound that was thrown away, excavated, to build half of a nuke. I was active at the beginning of Clamshell. I became the nonviolent training coordinator for the New England region of the Clamshell Alliance. Strategic nonviolent action has been a bridge through many, many, many seemingly disparate issues that my life has spanned. The exposure that I've had to Native culture and friends, teachers, over decades is truly profound, and I've never, ever seen the quality, depth, and breadth, wisdom, innate wisdom, that I witnessed at the Ochetti Sequin camp. There are four camps, each with their own separate protocols. I believe they're all working in harmony. Ochetti Sequin is on contested land that, as you very correctly pointed out, is entirely sovereign under U.S. law. If my law school training serves me, I believe that treaty law is second only to constitutional law under the five branches of U.S. law. We have thrown away the second highest level of laws, treaty law. I come from Mayflower descendants, and it's embarrassing, the 400 winters of broken treaties, abrogation of human rights. Standing Rock, what I heard very clearly, I was accepted as a, humbly, it was my honor and privilege to be accepted into a Native camp that was one of the original camps set up on the site. I found a role and a way to be of service, and I was able to hear circles of Native elders speaking where I had no business as a white ally, but being of service and working, I could hear. And one of the things I heard very clearly from some of the elders and some of the Native stories is that Standing Rock is only a beginning. This is only a beginning.
Well, I thank you, and I'm so glad that you had the experience, and it appears to be transformative on both sides. It was very heart-rending, really, to see the veterans taking on that role in peaceful fashion, of course, to, by their presence, indicate that they were on the side of justice. This was an extraordinary thing. But I go back to this original thought that I expressed today, that we have to stand up for the sovereignty of the First Nations. And in a sense, the pipeline issue served to bring us back to that discussion about sovereign rights of First Nations and the routine abrogation of the rights by the United States government, the failure to fulfill any aspect of sovereign rights of First Nations and the obligation to obey the law. This is not a matter for corporations to decide. This was not a matter for the Army Corps of Engineers to decide. This was a matter of nations, nation to nation, to decide. And that's what was clearly missing. It was an insult, I think, a major insult, and to the point of being, I don't know what the word is, to being deliberately racist and insulting. And disrespectful of, again, of treaties that were founded and worked out many, many years ago. And there has to be some way to revive this question about sovereignty of nations. The pipeline issue, as I said, served to bring this again to our attention. And we see that again, the United States insists it's not worth a discussion on a diplomatic level or a political level. It is kind of like a corporate question that belongs in the court to work out. Can't you guys work out a deal and call it a day? No, this is the invasion of a sovereign land. It happens to be within the boundaries of the United States, but it's their land. And they are sovereign nations in the United States, and that's a nation-to-nation kind of contact that should have addressed this question. But I'm so glad that you shared your thoughts on your experience there, and the way it has impacted you is so clear. I so appreciate your call today.
Kindly.
Thank you. Willie from Brooklyn.
Good afternoon, my beloved sister. How are we?
We are fine.
That's good. You know, sometimes I'm listening to you, and I said, my God, look at our chat here. I just listen, and I said, wow, there she goes again. That's how bad the sister is. That's how bad this is. The baddest thing in media, period. Matisse.
Yes, sir.
What I wanted to talk about a little bit is, you know, your president. You know, this guy really turns my stomach.
Why do you give him to me? I don't want him.
I've been trying to warn
people about him for how many years now? For 8 years.
Well, we got rid of the beast. The beast had to go. That beast had to go because she's just this thing, she's a real deplorable, in my judgment.
But we haven't gotten rid of her yet, Willie. We think we have, but we haven't. This whole thing, this big blow up that we are in now, that's her. That's her.
It's not going to work. Listen, it's not going to work unless we allow it to. You see what I'm saying? The Nation of Islam, they started out when was it, last year or this year? I don't remember. It said, up with Jesus and down with Santa. And that created a havoc across this country. Now, all we have to do is continue that program. You see what I'm saying? And until you do what we say, you got to get rid of this guy. Because number one, he's hateful, he's arrogant, he's ignorant, and he's just despicable and disrespectful. Look, now, the other day he made a comment. But you see, look, we black people, from my judgment, from my vantage point, we have no respect for ourselves. Because there's no way any of us should be seen with this guy. If you could remember the way he dealt with Barack. I mean, the brother, you know, we got problems with him, but we don't have that disrespect and hatred for him. Yes, he needs a spanking. No question about that. But the hatred that this guy showed for this brother, not only him, but Netanyahu. The brother is the president of the United States, no matter what you think. He was duly elected.
Well, he is. Trump has chosen an ambassador to the United Nations who believes the first order of business is to set up international headquarters in Jerusalem. And you know that's an act of provocation to set Jerusalem. That's, you know, but this is what is allowed. People are waiting, and maybe that's a good thing for people to wait and have the whole contingent assembled. But my question is, and this is what we've been talking about for months now, what is our political line of defense? Do we have any? We have no political vehicle that could take on this fight. First, we will now have to stop and construct one. But we have no real line of defense. So the question still comes down to, no matter what it is we choose to do, the most effective thing would require organization of the vehicle. We have to have a vehicle that is organized and that we can use effectively to achieve certain goals and objectives. We don't seem to have one.
I mean, from my sister, from my vantage point, we have the Nation of Islam. We have that.
We have the Nation of Islam, Islam is not a political party.
Well, we could make it one.
No, they don't. They're not involved in politics. Probably it's the reason that it still exists, is that it has removed itself from the swamp, if you will, of politics, and it is and independent to take on whatever projects or issues that it wants to take on. So it does not have the hindrance of a formalized political party and so forth, which means you play by the rules. In certain cases, you have to play by the rules and whatnot. They have an entirely different approach. And their model is the Garvey model, which was, of course, adopted by Elijah Muhammad.
Yes.
So that is an independent model of organization. My point is, whether it comes through that model, or you believe in the Claude Anderson model, or you believe in Amos Wilson model, or whichever model you choose, but that's their model, and you can see it's effective. But it still is operating within a clearly defined circle. And that is fine, because they are successful in achieving the goals that they set out to achieve with the apparatus that they have. In a broader sense, if we're talking party structure, we don't have anything right now that is well-organized and capable of delivering the punches that we need. It doesn't exist.
Well, from my vantage point, I don't think so, because, look, the Republican Party, just like you have said, that the Democratic Party has to be destroyed. I'm in total agreement with you. It has to be destroyed. Now, it doesn't matter which one wins, the Republican or Democrat. The end result, the bottom line is, we're in the same position that we've always been, and it'll never change for us. Okay, if you look at AIPAC, all right, anybody that wants to be anybody in this country has to go down, go before them, and bow down to them. You see what I'm saying?
To the American Israel Political Action Committee.
Exactly.
It's a very influential group.
Now, my point is, what if we said, okay, Mr. Trump the other day said that why don't we vote for him because we have nothing to lose. Do you think he could go in front of AIPAC and make a statement like that?
Yes, but you see, here's the irony of that. The irony of that is, it's kind of true. This is the sad reality of it.
Because
he is articulating what is in fact true.
Okay.
The leadership that historically had aligned itself with people of color, with people who are working poor, working just poor, or Poe, with 400 O's between the P and the R. Mm-hmm. If those people, those elements have just died, they no longer exist. They've been co-opted. They've sold out. A number of things have happened to make them absolutely irrelevant to the situation, because they are fighting literally for their own personal survival within the system. I mean, it goes as high as Bernie Sanders. We have no independent movements right now that have the muscle and the clout and the organization that could easily get us where we need to go on any number of issues. We don't have it. And Trump was kind of correct in saying that you have nothing to lose. Because on every front that any organized community would consider to be absolutely important to their survival, our schools are out. Our employment rates are ridiculous. You know, we could go down the list. We know the whole list. But the conditions persist, and in some cases have gotten even worse than they were before. And we have no effective political response as organized parties or organized political vehicles to represent our interests. That's done.
Well. Okay. Look, from my vantage point, this from my perspective. Look, let's say, okay, everybody, Gary Lala, respect the ground he walks on. because he's been so wonderful human being. And he had said he was advocating for Bernie. But Bernie could not burn me. Nor it, nor none of them. Or none of them, because I know who they are. Now, I do not suggest that you not vote, because we have paid a high price for voting. However, I voted, wrote the minister's name in. Now, these politicians, they whatever you have to get your vote. Okay. Now, we do know that the nation, ever since its existence, has always fought for the benefit of African people. Now, what if say 10 or 20 million of us wrote his name in? Now, a politician would have to look at that and say, well, wait a minute, how do I get these votes? Because it means something to them. Well, you, in order for me to consider that, you'd have to go to them. You see what I'm saying?
But so the point I'm making is, Minister Farrakhan, the Nation of Islam is functioning. This is the point that we have to understand. It's functioning. Both of them, the leader and the membership, are functioning well within their defined areas of interest. So we can't complain that they're not a generalist kind of organization. They never set out to be one. And yet they've had profound impact, perhaps more so than any other organization in the United States with respect to African Americans, Latinos, etc. The point I'm making is they set out, they were very definitive in what they want to do. With regard to the current election, for example, Minister Farrakhan just said one thing. That is a wicked woman. That's
right.
All he had to say.
Exactly. That's right.
That's all he had to say. So if anybody's thinking they're going to get any Nation of Islam member to vote for Hillary Clinton, you better have another thought coming. All he had to say was, that is a wicked woman. That's it.
But we still had to vote, Sister Utrecht.
But they don't vote. This is the point. The members of the Nation of Islam will vote only when there is a need to vote. And to my knowledge, they've never figured out that there is a need to vote, because all their needs are met. They have a microeconomy. They have their own schools. They create their own jobs. They build their own housing in some cases. So they do not have a relationship of dependence on any system but the one that they created. So my point is, that's great. It works for them, and that's fantastic. How do we duplicate that?
But
because they also do not wish to be part of the general population. They don't wish that. It's like the Mennonites.
That.
It's like the Amish of Pennsylvania. It's like ultra-Orthodox Jews. They have their own definition of what politics should mean to them. It's like Seventh-day Adventists. They don't vote, but their needs are met. So
we have to figure how is that model
To be replicated in all these different pockets. Blacks are voting and have been voting. They even died for it. Now,
what exactly has
been the return on that investment?
Nothing.
Okay. Well, practically nothing. But this is the idea. So it means that we are investing in failing systems, and we keep repeating the error. So the point is that we have to wake up and devise something that works. It's as simple as that. As simple as that. There are many groups in the United States comprising millions of people who do not participate in the political process. But they have jobs, they have homes, They send their children to schools that they like and approve of. And they generally are happy with their communities within which they live. Whatever people want to think, they could think. But the fact is, when you will have a rough time trying to convince an Amish person to join the Democratic Party or the Republicans or to come and live in Detroit. It's not going to happen.
Okay. Can I respond to that?
Sure.
You please? Yeah.
Yes.
You see, that I blame on the PR and the listeners. I blame that on them.
You're going to blame the PR and listeners for the fact that the Mennonites and the Amish don't want to move and don't see a need to change their life and lifestyle.
Listen, my sister, the reason why many of us are caught up with these two parties is very simple. They don't know the truth. PRN present you with, particularly your program, presents you with that. Now, if we were really doing our jobs like we were supposed to, that audience would be maybe 100, 200 million people in this country if we were serious about what we're doing.
Wait. Don't gloss over that. That is the key. That's the killer phrase right there. If we were serious about it. As the saying goes, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And it is a process. It's a long-haul process of education. And we hope at some point that enough people would see the need to change course and to divest themselves of this two-party system and come together with others, other like-minded people who believe there must be another answer. There's got to be, and we are the ones to find it and build it. Which is why I was so upset this past 2 weeks about the Green Party, because they started this whole mess.
They are working with the Democratic Party.
Well, you know, this is what we have to be mindful of. Our thinking has to change. Maybe, you know, you have a different name, or you have a different venue that you're operating in, but if the mindset hasn't changed and the way of doing things hasn't changed, then we're right back where we started from. But you still have to congratulate yourself. If you get a couple, 5, 10 people who can tell us, we had heard, I think it was last week or so, from Henry from Chicago, who organized or was part of a group, a small group in Chicago that organized a kind of support your local folk event.
I heard a program. I heard Henry. Yes, I did.
Now, that lifted me all week because it was such an accomplishment. And all it took was initiative and to begin the process of creating something different, a different vehicle. That's all it takes to recognize. Or we heard from David talking about, you don't have to live with cracked sidewalks, or here's a way to get more trees on your block.
Right.
These are the signs that you look for people who are doing something very different. It may be small, but it's effective. As long as it's effective, you're winning. So we've got to do that. We've come to the end of the program, Willie. Good to hear from you. Thank you for calling in and contributing.
Okay,
thank you all. We've run out of time, and we still have so many people in line to go. And I've got to find a way to solve this. And I'll work on it. To get as much time as we can to accommodate all people, because people listen to this particular aspect of the program religiously, and they enjoy hearing other people's views. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus, always a great program to listen to. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com. It's a pleasure, always, and a great privilege to be in your company. I really mean that. And this is Friday, the start of the weekend. Do everything positive and surround yourselves with people who bring positive dimension to your life. We'll see you on Monday for some more talk.
Same old story. It's the same, it's the same, it's the same, it's the same old thing.